Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dill, Jason Croft is at the controls. This morning, we're pleased to have back here with us in the studio Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month, he's here on the program for this show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. As you know, probably if you listen to the program, periodically throughout the year, we have various physicians on the show. And many of them specialize in particular parts of the body. But we, a long time ago, we thought, well, it would be a good idea to have someone on the program who had a more general kind of focus. And Dr. Jeff said, yeah, he would do that. So the idea is, if you have questions about your health, could be for yourself, could be for someone in your family, could be for children, because he does see all people of all ages in his practice, little ones, bigger ones. If you have questions, you can give us a call. And I know that he will try to help you out. We always I always try to say on these programs that people need to understand we can't do diagnosis over the phone because the doctor can't see you. And you may, you may want to take up the issue with your own doctor, at least somebody that you can talk to face to face. But doing these programs, it's a good general way to talk about health and to answer questions. And if you have some basic stuff you want to call in, discuss that with the doctor. And then, of course, you might want to take that up with your own doctor, but this is a place that you can start. So the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, pick up the telephone and give us a call. Well, good to have you here.
Thank you, David. Good to be back.
I have nothing in particular to talk about. I don't know. Is there anything that's really that you think is particularly, I don't know, if it's been in the news or it's been big that you've been seeing a lot of people with a particular complaint? I have this feeling that this is probably one of those times when maybe it's a little on the quiet side, actually.
I think the thing that's been in the news the most recently has been the weather.
Ah, good. You're going to talk about heat stroke.
And I was just going to mention that that's sort of a seasonal hazard, especially for folks who work outdoors. Mm-hmm. The heat and the humidity are a dangerous combination if you don't remain adequately hydrated and make an attempt to cool off. There are some very serious medical problems that can come from increased body temperature. But the other thing that people sometimes don't remember is it's not just the construction worker or the farmer out in the hot fields that can suffer from heat injury, especially older folks and newborns. Basically, the extremes of age have difficulty managing regulation of their temperature compared to normal healthy adults, and simply being in a very warm environment, even if you're not exerting yourself, can potentially cause a problem. Mm-hmm. And a number of, especially elderly folks with medical conditions where they're a little bit more frail to begin with, will not tolerate the higher temperatures. And there are also medications that people are sometimes taking that either prevent them from cooling themselves as normally as possible or directly interfere with their ability to maintain adequate hydration. So people really do need to be aware of the fact that the high heat and especially the high humidity definitely make it much more problematic in terms of keeping yourself cool and healthy.
So two things other than making sure that you drink plenty of water, preferably just water.
Preferably water.
So make sure you have plenty of water. And then when you do get into these really high temperatures, high humidities, then to try to reduce your level of activity when it's hottest, just try and take it easy. Other than that?
What I would probably say is for the otherwise healthy folks, make sure that you check on the older folks. If there's an elderly person who's in a house that doesn't have air conditioning, that's a problem. And you've probably read, like in some of the bigger cities, they have cooling centers mm-hmm. where people can actually go during the course of the day to literally try and cool off. And I think that's important that people realize that is something that some of the older folks, especially if they're not very mobile, may need help with.
Okay. And even for people who would consider themselves to be in average health, Are there some particular signs that you would say you should look for that shows that you're getting into a heat problem?
Yes. Generally, what happens when we become sort of overheated, our body attempts to regulate and bring our temperature back down, primarily by sweating. And that's one of the key reasons why you have to replace that fluid, because it's kind of like if the water runs out of your radiator in your car, it overheats. Mm. And the same thing's true for people. If you can't sweat, and that's primarily how we get rid of our excess heat, is that moisture comes to the surface, and as the air blows by, it basically evaporates, carrying the heat with it. I think everybody's had the experience of, even on a very hot day, if you get out of the pool, and, you know, you have water on you and a little breeze goes by, you almost feel chilled even though the temperature is 95. And that's kind of how we cool ourselves normally. And that's why it's such a problem when the humidity goes up, because it makes it much harder for our body to get water to evaporate into the air when the air is already saturated with moisture. And so our natural mechanism of sweating becomes less effective, and people need to simply be aware of that combination. So there really is a difference. You know, when people say, oh, I was out in Arizona, it was 110, but it was a dry heat, which I've always thought was kind of humorous. But there really is physiologically a difference, because you can still sweat in that kind of environment and cool yourself. Now, if it's 110 and the humidity's, you know, like 80%, it's very, very difficult for you to sweat and get that moisture and the heat that it carries off of your body. So these are situations in the Midwest that are really a problem, and people simply need to be aware of it and plan for it. And the key is, you know, keep your fluids up and go someplace cooler when you can. But somebody who you know, gets to the point where they're so overheated, they're going to run out of sweat. They're going to start to breathe hard. You've seen a dog panting when they get hot. We do the same thing. We breathe harder because we can exchange a lot of moisture through our air and lungs that way. Mm-hmm. But again, we're losing fluids when we do that. So like our little radiator, if we start to get too low, we're going to overheat. And then if you're losing, you're sweating and you're breathing as hard as you can, you're going to start to see the internal changes. Most people who literally have heat stroke end up dying as a result of the complications that high heat produces within the body. A number of enzymatic systems within our body simply fail to work at a certain temperature, and then you basically end up having your liver and your kidneys and ultimately your brain and cardiac and other muscle functions start to deteriorate as a result of that. And you know, that's a little late to be intervening in the process.
Okay. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. This is a program we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do it every other month on a Monday, and it's your opportunity to ask healthcare questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller in Chicago, line 4, the toll free line.
Thank
Hello.
You. I've
yes.
heard, quite a bit of comments that people should watch out for the leg relating to peripheral artery disease. Could you give me a summary or description of that and what can be done for that? I'm trying to keep my legs up. Recently, about a week ago now, it's been swelling up on the one leg, and it subsides in the evening when I rest and keep the feet up, elevated over the body, but then in the next day it just continues to return. I'm wondering what I'm in for.
We can discuss the two types of vascular disease that commonly occur in the lower extremities. Peripheral arterial disease is generally the first half of that, the arterial side of the circulation, the part that's pumping blood out to your extremities. And then there's the venous part of your vascular system where blood is returning from the extremities back into the central part of the body to be reoxygenated and pumped out again. But on the arterial side, generally speaking, folks who have problems with blockages in the arteries as they go down into their extremities have the same risk factors that somebody has when they have heart disease. They have high blood pressure, they smoke, they have cholesterol problems, they might have diabetes, they're overweight, they're not getting enough exercise. All of those things that we typically associate with heart disease are also associated with arterial disease, because we're talking about the same kind of blood vessels, just in a different part of the body. In many instances, people with arterial disease with the lower extremities have, as their primary complaint, pain in their legs when they attempt to walk. Basically, as they walk, the muscles of the lower extremities need more oxygen that has to be carried by the blood supply. And if there's a blockage in that blood supply, then you're not getting enough oxygen and your muscles become real unhappy about that. And people will say, you know, I can walk, you know, three blocks and then I have to stop because my legs hurt and I have to sit down and rest. And then I can walk another three blocks and then I have to sit down, you know. So depending on how far you walk, if that's getting less and less and less, then there's probably progressive blockage in those blood vessels. The same kind of tests that are done for heart disease with an angiogram where they put dye in the blood vessels looking for blockage can be done on the lower extremity blood vessels. And the same kinds of medications and surgical treatments can be applied to the peripheral arterial disease as to heart disease. You can basically put in stents, you can put in catheters, you can balloon things, you can bypass things surgically. So it's basically as such a subset of what we'd refer to as cardiovascular disease. Most of the time we're thinking of our heart, but the other half of cardiovascular is your vascular tree, and the major blood vessels that come out of the heart that carry blood down into our lower extremities are fairly commonly affected when people also have heart disease. On the venous side, probably the most common thing that people are aware of are things like varicose veins. And those are simply dilatations in the veins returning blood back from the legs. They can be physically uncomfortable and, again, can be treated either with compression stockings or, again, the abnormal veins can be surgically removed. The other concern about persistent swelling, as our caller mentioned, is always the possibility of blood clot forming in a leg, and that is more of a risk when people have venous problems, because blood will pool in there and sit, and the stasis after a while leads to an increased chance of coagulation and clot formation. Now, swelling that tends to come and go, depending on what position you're in, may simply be related to the fluid status, and there are a variety of things that can affect the fluid status of a given individual. Medications that they're taking, underlying medical conditions such as congestive heart failure. So anybody who's having pain, discomfort, or recurrent swelling in their extremities really should be seeing their personal physician and getting that checked out.
I have a low blood pressure to begin with, to say that, and I'm sort of young at heart, do a lot of walking and in fact a lot of bicycling, but this suddenly occurred about a week ago, and I was wondering how critically dangerous it is now. Thinking of trying to pursue some natural ways of dealing with it before thinking of any surgical intervention. Am I in real danger in attempting to think of some alternative ways?
In terms of the swelling, if it's only in one leg,
yeah,
and it is relatively new in onset, then yes, I think that ought to be checked out.
The major, thank you very much.
Major concern would be clot.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And we'll talk with somebody else here. Next up is someone in Sycamore, up in the northern part of the state. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was out mowing the lawn for an hour or two last Friday during some pretty hot weather, and I noticed that it was my heart rate stayed high after I was finished and came in and had dinner, and even for a couple of hours into the evening, it was elevated, you know, maybe around 90 beats per minute for quite a number of hours before it slowly calmed down at the end of the day, just before bedtime. And I was wondering if that was a result of heat exhaustion or dehydration or both.
It actually could be a symptom of mild forms of both, in the sense that one of our compensatory mechanisms is as we get hot, we open up our blood vessels and we move them closer to the surface of the skin in an attempt to radiate the heat away from us. And your heart will also then try to pump that blood faster so that it can circulate more of that warm blood to the surface in an attempt to, again, radiate that heat away from you. And that response will persist until your temperature actually returns back to its normal state, and that would last longer than the activity that you were doing outside. So, yes, that is possible.
Well, I took my temperature, and it was elevated only a few tenths of a degree. Certainly wouldn't classify as a fever at all, but it was slightly higher than my normal resting temperature.
Right. And fever and temperature are sometimes, they share some similar characteristics. They're actually different in terms of what's going on internally. Fever, when someone is ill, is usually an inflammatory response caused by internal chemical reactions. The elevation in temperature that occurs from activity outdoors in a warm environment really doesn't have anything to do with, having a fever. So that is, in terms of how you treat it, somewhat differently. If somebody has an elevated temperature because of their ambient environment as opposed to fever, then giving them Tylenol or aspirin isn't going to help. In your particular case, how much of a difference that was between your outside temperature when you were working and when you finally came in, you'd really have to measure that while you're outdoors to know how much of a difference that was.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think the standard advice, as we discussed at the beginning, was when you're going to be outside and when it's really hot and you're sweating, you need to replace that fluid. And the best, easiest, cheapest thing to do is just drink water.
Right.
Now there are products that are available, and they're really targeted. They seem really to be targeted to athletes. Gatorade and stuff like that, which is water plus some other stuff. Is that really, does that really do anything?
It really depends on the, I would say, the degree of exertion and how prolonged the activity and the temperature exposure is going to be. If you're going to be outside for half an hour, weeding in the garden, if you want to come in and have, a glass of iced tea or ice water or something, that's fine. And that's probably all you need. If you are doing three-a-day football practices in this kind of weather, you probably are going to need a little bit more than just water. And most of the Gatorade, sports drink kind of things have some sugar, some sodium, some potassium. Some of the other things that are lost and that do, in fact, need to be replaced if there's prolonged exposure to high heat and activities that are going to lead to dehydration. So, yes, I think those are reasonable things to do if you're doing very vigorous activities and especially if it's prolonged. Yeah. But in many instances, even for folks at home, if they've got a series of outside activities that are going to take up 3 or 4 hours, ideally they would want to break those up into half-hour chunks and then come in after a half hour, cool off, replenish their fluids, and plan their activities so that you're not doing 4 hours at a time.
Yeah. All right. Questions welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen, and he's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. This is a show we call Talk to the Family Doctor, and we do this every other month, always on a Monday, an opportunity for people to call in and ask questions. As I said at the beginning of the show, he sees adults in his practice and children as well, so this could be a question for yourself, could be for someone in your family, grown up, little person, whichever, you can give us a call. And I think we have someone here to talk with in Crete on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
General, I've been thank you for the excellent program, by the way.
Sure.
General, I have been diagnosed with asthma, And I'm wondering what is. I understand it's an immune problem. Is it curable from any standpoint, or is it just manageable from a? I guess just general comments like that. I'll hang up and thank you very much for the program.
All right.
Thank you for the call. Asthma is a fairly broad topic, and there are obviously subsets that are slightly different. But in general, the questions caller regarding immunity tends to revolve around the fact that asthma and allergies are often seen together. Now, there are some individuals who have one but not the other, but it's actually fairly common to see both. And as such, we know that our allergic response is some type of unusual immune reaction to something. And in susceptible individuals, that immune response triggers constriction of the bronchial tubes. And consequently, you have trouble moving air in and out of your lungs, and then you make that characteristic wheezing noise that people sort of characterize as the hallmark of asthma. And as such, the treatment for asthma can center either around medications to open up the bronchial tubes, and a lot of the inhaled medications are basically bronchodilators, so that, again, you find it easier to move air in and out of your lungs. But the other portion of asthma treatment most recently has focused on, are there inhaled medications that can be used to sort of alter the immune response to those bronchial tubes so that they don't tend to constrict? So the current recommendations for treatment, and I'll go ahead and say basically there is no cure for asthma, but it is something that can be very well managed and well controlled, and people really shouldn't have to significantly restrict their activities because of it if it's well managed. But the treatment basically centers around if somebody has an occasional problem with their breathing, then the occasional use of a bronchodilator, usually inhaled form, is fine. If you only need to use that a couple times a month, that's probably perfectly okay to treat it like that. And if somebody says, gee, yeah, the bronchodilator works for me, but I'm using it all the time, I feel like I need to, then we basically add in the next line of medications, which are medications designed to be used on a daily basis to help prevent the bronchoconstriction that causes the wheezing. And those folks then find themselves not needing to use their bronchodilators nearly as often. The major concern with asthma is if what's commonly referred to as an asthma attack gets bad, the bronchoconstriction can become so pronounced and severe that it's very difficult and sometimes, in very sad cases, irreversible. And people die from asthma being either treated not adequately enough or too late. And so in most instances, we really encourage folks, if they find that they're needing their bronchodilator frequently, to talk that over with their physician, because there are much better medications to help prevent people from getting into a bad problem. Now, if somebody says, you know, I'm taking my medications and I'm still having a lot of trouble and they have a lot of allergy symptoms, then treating their allergies will frequently help their asthma as well. And the standard treatment for allergies, if you know what it is that you're allergic to, stay away from it. Mm-hmm. And two, you can use the antihistamine-type medications to block the allergic response. And for people with primarily nasal allergy symptoms, these can also affect their respiratory tract. The inhaled nasal medications for prevention of allergic reactions is helpful as well. And then for folks who really still need more help beyond that, immunotherapy, allergy shots as such, are used for some individuals where all of those preceding things haven't been enough.
For people who do have this kind of reactive airway problem, there can be a variety of triggers that can be problem for them. And some of the common things are things like smoke, house dust, mm-hmm. pet hair, you know, there are a number of things. And so it could be helpful to know one of those things which you're really going to be sensitive to, so that then you can do what you can to limit your exposure.
Right.
Is it – how important do you think it is to actually know, and you might go – you know, they were still doing scratch tests and try to figure out what it is that people are reacting to.
In the majority of cases, people figure it out. Every time I go to grandma's house who has the cat,
I get all,
eyes itch, my nose runs, I start sneezing, and my asthma flares.
So obviously the problem is grandma.
Exactly. And there is no shot for grandma. So in most instances, it's a pattern recognized over time. That's why there is a hay fever season. You know, the second week of August, we're coming up on this pretty soon here. Yeah. People will say, geez, you know, my allergies are really bad. And so in most instances, it's not a big surprise. In a few instances where people really say, I've tried to cut all my exposures, I can't figure it out. There's no one particular time of year. There's no one particular place. There's no one particular exposure that seems to set me off. If they're still having significant problems despite all the other things we talked about, then allergy testing may be useful. But the primary benefit of allergy testing is to figure out what it is that you're allergic to so that you can produce the extract that's going to be then used for your allergy shots. But just say, well, I think I have allergies. I'm going to go get, a whole bunch of allergy testing. That's usually not terribly helpful.
Okay. Let's talk with someone else. We have someone here in Urbana to talk with on our line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Has there been any progress with treatment, topical treatment for fungal infections of the nails?
That's a really tough one. By and large, topical treatment for fungal nail infections is not terribly effective. And really, the pretty much gold standard is systemic oral antifungal medication, usually taken for, several months, usually 8 weeks for fingernails and 12 weeks for toenails. And those have a fairly good track record. The problem being is that simply treating it once won't prevent you from getting it again if you're exposed, and exposure is virtually everywhere. So it's not at all uncommon for people to come in contact with the fungus that causes those funny-looking nails. So I usually tell my patients, if you can trim the nail, it's not ingrowing, it's not painful, it's not snagging on your socks, or, you can still get your shoes on. If it doesn't hurt and you just simply want to live with an ugly toenail, medically that's probably okay. If it really, really bugs you, then you're usually going to look at either removing the nail surgically and oral antifungal agents. Occasionally removing the nail and really being aggressive with topical therapy will work. But again, any treatment for one episode of a fungal nail won't necessarily prevent you from getting it again down the road if you get exposed.
Okay.
There are some complications with the oral.
The oral medication is systemic, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. and the drug is processed through the liver, so basically folks with any predisposing problems related to their liver probably shouldn't be taking it, and it certainly should be discussed with one's physician if you're already on some other type of medication that's also processed through your liver. And one of the most common things now are the cholesterol-lowering drugs, which are pretty rampant in terms of their use. So you really have to have a conversation about the pros and cons of the medication with your physician and decide, how big a problem is this and what am I willing to do about it. But normally, if somebody's on the systemic antifungal medications, we usually monitor tests related to their liver function every 4 to 6 weeks while they're on the medication.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. The guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. If you remove a nail, will it grow back?
Yes.
So, okay. So that is, they don't have to go around without a nail on that.
No, but interestingly, I've had folks either with fungal nails or simply recurrent ingrown toenails where one of the treatments is, in fact, just remove it and let it grow back in. And if you do okay, that's great. Mm-hmm. But I've had a couple of folks where they didn't do okay. Every time it grew back in, it was either fungally involved again or was ingrowing. And you can remove the nail and then kill the nail bed, and then no nail grows back. And people always think that's going to be, you know, a little odd or weird. But in fact, the top part of the toe where your nail used to be pretty much toughens up and becomes like regular skin. And so it's not unusually sensitive or tender. And in fact, I've seen women who paint that space
to match the
other toenails. And unless you look closely, it's really not that noticeable.
Huh, okay. Well, very good. We have some other callers here. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I got a question for the doctor.
Yeah.
For kidney pain, I wonder what is good to drink, like cranberry juice. That's what everybody's telling me. That's my question.
Well, I need to know from you what you mean by kidney pain.
Oh, in my back, on both kidneys, they just start aching and start hurting. Now, that's basically all I can tell you, really.
Do you have any urinary symptoms, pain or discomfort when you urinate or blood in your urine?
No, not that I know of.
Okay. It's unless you have some known pre-existing kidney disease, like polycystic kidneys, it's highly unlikely that the discomfort that you're having in your back is related to your kidneys. Now, the area of your back may, in fact, be near where your kidneys are, but it's highly unlikely that your discomfort is coming from your kidneys. Your comment about cranberry juice is related to the fact that for folks, typically women, who get frequent urinary tract infections, if you can sometimes make the urine more acidic by consuming large quantities of basically citrus-type products that have a lot of acid in them, you can sometimes inhibit the growth of bacteria. But there isn't anything specific about cranberry juice that's going to basically help just an achy back.
Okay, so what you're basically telling me is an acidic type drink might help?
If we're talking about preventing urinary tract infections, yes.
Okay, but nothing specifically for kidney pain in my back?
No.
Okay, well, maybe I'll see my regular doctor.
I think that would be a good place to start.
Okay, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Next, we'll talk with someone in Kansas, Illinois, and this is line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I have two family members who have been afflicted with the infection under the classification of the MRSA. Both of them apparently got theirs from reusing a razor when they were shaving their legs. There was an article recently in Reader's Digest that was really quite scary about these types of superbugs. And honestly, when I watch the commercials on TV for razors, they really promote reusing razors for quite a long time. So I'm just curious if the razor industry isn't caught up with medical problems that might be caused by reusing razors. I've also thought if I could soak a razor in alcohol, if that would help. But do you have any recommendations for that to help us to prevent getting this type of infection?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I've really seriously thought about that a whole lot. There really isn't a problem with the same person reusing the razor, because the only thing that's going to be on it are things that were already on your skin to begin with. Now, when different people share the same razor, there is the possibility of transferring bacteria from one individual to the other. But this is really actually only a problem in a setting where you would cut yourself. If your razor is truly staying on the top part of the skin and you're removing hair but not cutting the skin, it really shouldn't be a problem at all. The real difficulty comes with these types of infection when there's a break in the skin and we lose that protective barrier that keeps the bacteria on the outside. And in this particular case, using a new razor would not prevent you from getting an infection if, in fact, you cut yourself, because what you're doing is simply allowing bacteria that are normally present on the skin inside. And in that particular case, even if you had a sterile razor, it wouldn't prevent the infection, because the infection itself is coming from the bacteria that are on the skin.
Okay, well, I guess I was misinformed. I was assuming that the bacteria was from skin and such that had stayed inside the razor and was left to sit out and possibly grow bacteria in the razor, which would increase the bacteria on your skin.
Actually, you have hundreds of thousands of bacteria on every square inch of your skin normally. So, you know, a couple extra on the razor really isn't going to make much difference. It's really the break in the skin that's the key part.
Okay, so just be extra careful, huh?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions, again, are welcome. We have about 10 minutes. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I was going to ask you in general about urologic health, and maybe I prompted by the earlier call that we had. And I was just going to ask, just because I came across an article about a study that came out a couple of months ago. It was done by the National Institutes of Health, taking a look. They went back. The figures were from the year 2000, but I'm assuming that, you know, they would be pretty much still the same. Looking at the amount of money that we spend on various kinds of urologic conditions. And the thing that really stood out to me was that apparently, at least in this year they were looking at, in the year 2000, that here in the United States we spent almost $3.5 billion treating urinary tract infections. And so I guess that, you know, my question was, well, is there are there some things that we all could be doing to just reduce the possibility that we might have a urinary tract infection? I suppose, other than, you know, making sure you're well hydrated and things are going in and going out, you know, you're flushing as much as possible. In anything else?
If we look at the general topic of, let's say, bladder infections, because of all of the urinary tract infections, that's probably the most common. Mm-hmm. You know, when you say urinary tract, well, are you talking about your kidney, your ureters, your bladder, the urethra, exactly what it is that you're kind of talking about. Mm-hmm. The single most common is going to be your typical bladder infection. It is not common in children. It is not common in men. Bladder infections are relatively common in women. And as such, it occasionally happens. You know, if there's 100 million women in the United States and something happens to each of them occasionally, that's still several hundred million occurrences. Mm. And so this is a relatively common problem, generally not serious if the infection stays in the bladder. It's very annoying and uncomfortable, but usually not serious as such, and in some instances, really pushing the fluids, making the urine more acidic, are things that can be done to either prevent or sometimes even treat if you catch it early enough. But in all likelihood, a lot of the cost associated with this probably results from laboratory work. A urine culture is fairly expensive, and also probably relates to the cost of medications. As with, you know, lots of areas, anything that's new must be better, but of course it costs more. So there's actually fairly widespread use of fairly expensive antibiotics when, in fact, much cheaper generic medications would probably work just as well. So I think a fair amount of the cost is probably related to laboratory and prescription costs rather than, you know, just the inherent problem itself. Though the problem itself is very frequent, so if you just add up all the office visits or hospital emergency room visits, you know, it would probably add up to quite a bit. But in women, probably one of the more frequent causes of repetitive urinary tract infections is intercourse, and simply making sure that you empty the bladder immediately afterwards. And in some instances where this pattern's been noted, a single dose of an antibiotic taken afterwards can help prevent bladder infections. Anatomically, women's urethra is very, very short, and there's a very small distance between the outside world and the bladder, and they're unfortunately just anatomically a little bit more prone to getting bacteria into the bladder, and that's why we see that much more commonly in women than in men.
All right. Let's talk to somebody in Mahomet, line number one. Hello.
Thanks for the excellent show. Really sure. Appreciate it. My question is prompted by the cranberry question. As a matter of fact, just last Friday, I was discharged from Carl after a very severe bleeding ulcer episode. And you mentioned the acidity and so forth. And I'm just wondering, should I be avoiding all citrus and cranberries and that sort of type thing?
Not necessarily. Generally, with gastrointestinal ulcers, what's really recognized now as being the primary problem is the infection with a particular bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. And eradicating that bacteria significantly reduces the likelihood of recurrent ulcer problems. The other portion of the ulcer problem that was much more heavily emphasized in the past was, in fact, the amount of acid in the stomach, and it's still quite common now to prescribe medications to reduce acid production, and this is your Prilosec, Prevacid, Tagamet, Zantac-type medications. In terms of diet, there are a few things that we tell people to avoid if they've had some ulcer problems, and they basically can be listed as tobacco, alcohol, caffeine, and the anti-inflammatory agents, the Advil, Aleve-type medications. And otherwise, in terms of what you have to eat or to drink, is pretty much up to you. You know, some people say, gee, every time I have tomato sauce, it gives me heartburn or indigestion. You know, we say, fine, then don't eat that. But in terms of specifically having to restrict your diet, there really isn't anything special that you have to do. If it doesn't bother you, you can have whatever you like.
So coffee's out, huh?
The caffeine and actually some of the other components of coffee tend to simply be irritating. Nicotine, alcohol, caffeine, and then the anti-inflammatory agents are things that can definitely be a problem when people's ulcers have flared up. And that's not to say that once, you know, in a couple months things have settled down that you can't have, you know, a cup of coffee in the morning to wake up. So.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. As I said, I think the big one of the big changes that's happened within, I don't know, the past 20, 30 years, I suppose, is the appreciation that ulcer disease, in many cases, maybe not every case, but in many cases, what you're dealing with is a bacterial infection, this H. pylori.
In the lining of the stomach. Right.
And then so your treatment, once you have determined for sure that that's present, you've got to know that it's there.
Right.
That you treat that with antibiotics. And,
correct.
And it's been the big change. What are the chances if you've had that once and you are successfully treated, is it likely that, is this something that's likely to come back? Or in most cases, once you get
90% of the time, it takes care of itself. In the past, when ulcer disease was being treated as just an acid-related problem, ulcers were very frequently recurrent. And nobody really kind of understood that. Since treating for the H. pylori has become prevalent, the recurrence rate is dramatically down.
And is that H. pylori, again, one of these things that's just Just out there.
It's just out there.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. And some people seemingly have it and don't get ulcers. And there's a subset of people who have it and then develop an ulcer. And getting rid of it definitely improves their ulcer healing.
Hmm. Okay. Some of the callers here. Next, we'll talk with someone in Charleston. This is line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, I was going to answer David's question about how to get rid of or avoid, prevent cystitis. I have a book called Cystitis, The Complete Self-Help Guide by Angela Keel-Martin. Came out a number of years ago. It says, takes charge of your body and never suffer from cystitis again. Anyway, its first recommendation is the proper care before and after intercourse that can help you avoid infection. And what they said is, first, both partners need to be clean. Second, after intercourse, the woman needs to get up, use the bathroom, urinate, get the water or the urine out of the system, which will clear any kind of things that have gotten caught up in that part of the body, and then wash again. And I think that would be helpful for many women.
Yeah, and pretty simple, straightforward. Not,
and you're exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Great, all right. Well,
bye-bye.
Thank you. And then let's go again to another caller here. This is someone in Urbana, I'm told, in line four. Hello.
Yes, yes. I have a question about essentially my son. They said his blood cells were small, his red blood cells, and because that was probably due to iron deficiency. And we've been feeding him iron that they have given us, but he really hates it, tastes terrible, and I couldn't imagine eating it myself. And it's been staining his teeth as well. We were wondering, is there some alternative? Can we just feed him a lot of spinach and red meat and things that are rich in iron instead of that?
How old is your son?
He's 2 years old.
2 years old. Did he have some additional laboratory work to definitely define
yes.
iron deficiency?
Yeah, they said that he was iron deficient, and that's why they prescribed prescription iron.
And other causes for small red blood cells were eliminated, like lead exposure?
Yes.
Okay.
And so they did the lead test, and there's also, I guess, some genetic tests that, what is it?
Things like thalassemia.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so that was, ruled out. He would drink a lot of milk, and we were sort of skeptical that that was the reason why he was iron deficient.
It is possible, and that, is the reason why currently infants are not recommended to be given cow's milk, because there's basically no iron in it. Cow's milk is a good source of, general nutrition, calories, those sorts of things, but there's no iron in there. And so you can, in fact, gain weight really well, but become quite anemic if most of your calories are being consumed in the form of cow's milk.
He was breastfed, though, till how long? Till 15 months.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we went over to cow's milk. Yeah.
Sure. Has there been any evaluation to see if he's actually losing any blood?
He's not anemic, and his hemoglobin. He is anemic, but his hemoglobin level is actually very good.
Okay. But basically, your body will produce more small cells if it can't produce a normal amount of big cells.
Okay.
And so even though his hemoglobin is still in normal range, this would be the step right before you would officially declare somebody being anemic. So their cells get smaller first,
okay. And
then you lose them entirely. But the real question here is, are you simply not getting enough iron in which case you need to replace it, which is kind of what you're doing now, or are you losing iron? And losing iron usually means you're losing red blood cells somewhere.
Okay.
In kids, this would be most commonly blood lost from the intestinal tract.
Okay.
And you may not be able to visibly see any blood in his stools, but it would certainly be quite reasonable to check. And there's a very simple kit that people take home to check for blood in the stool. It's actually the same test that we give to adults for screening for colon cancer.
Okay.
and make sure that there isn't something going on internally in the intestinal tract that's causing just a very slight blood loss.
Okay.
Because that would be treated basically differently than somebody who's simply not absorbing iron and needs to take more iron.
Okay. And then where would we get that test?
Oh, your regular physician should be able to give you that.
Okay. And what is it called again?
It's called a hemocult test.
Okay. Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you very much for the information.
You're welcome.
Very good. Well, thank you. We, I think, are just about at the time that we would finish up. Any last little thought you might like to leave with folks?
Be cool.
Going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, yeah, watch out because it sounds like the here for us, where we live, Champaign-Urbana, the rest of this week could be pretty unpleasant. And it's August, so, you know, I guess that's what you come to expect. It's going to be warm for a while before it gets cool. And particularly if you have young athletes in your house, you might really, want to make sure that they stay on their hydration. You would hope that the coaches are going to be on top of this, but, they should be on top of that, too.
A good piece of advice.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month, he's here on a Monday, and we talk about health. This is the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor.